This is the Mason Vera Payne Show, your go-to lifestyle program, covering everything from technology and gaming to movies, TV shows, and pop culture to the supernatural and beyond. Brought to you by WGNRadio.com with your host, the unabridged millennial, Mason Vera Payne.
This is Mason Vera Payne, live from the MVP Studios in Chicago, and thank you for tuning in. Today, we're going to cover all things games, from releases to current news and even some old games that may or may not come out. Ray Casello, review editor at EGM Now, joins me to give a rundown of what's going on in the gaming world. Thanks for joining me, Ray.
Thanks for having me again, Mason.
All right, so we're going to go back in time for a minute, and I want to talk about the Final Fantasy VII Remake. What happened to that? Because that was back in, 2015? And has there been any news about it lately?
So there has been no news, but we do know it is still coming. The folks over at Square Enix are still supposedly working on it, but I think that they've kind of switched their focus now to finishing Kingdom Hearts 3. And I think that once that's out the door, they'll turn their attention back to Final Fantasy VII. So, I mean, it is disappointing that they announced it in 2015, and the honest truth is we might not get it till 2019 or even 2020 because of what they're doing in terms of bringing the game up to date and in terms of trying to try new things with it. And so it'll be interesting to see when we finally hear from it again, but I don't think we'll hear from Square Enix Japan in terms of Final Fantasy VII probably until after or at least near the release of Kingdom Hearts 3.
You know, speaking of trying new things, I read somewhere, and I don't know if this is even true anymore, that they were going to make Final Fantasy VII episodic. Did you hear that too or no?
Yes, to the best of my knowledge, the last I heard is that Final Fantasy VII was indeed still aiming to be an episodic adventure, an episodic release. How they're going to do that with an RPG, I'm not exactly sure, but it kind of goes in line with a lot of what a lot of companies have been trying to do with episodic, and I think that they saw the success of certain games that there's like Life is Strange and Hitman, and realize that if they're done properly and if they give clear like chapter breaks, they could probably get away with doing it episodically. And this would also give them time to continue polishing certain parts of the game, just focus on episode by episode and continue to polish a little well after the first episode releases. Now, again, knowing how Square Enix releases things, I worry that it could be 6 months between episodes. But the hope is that when they do release it, is that then they'll do what they did with Hitman, they did with Life is Strange, which they'll do a full disc compilation. They'll then pull everything together anyway so that you can play it all at once, should you so choose, like in the old school PS1 era.
Yeah, I like being able to play it all the way through. Do you think episodic games are more beneficial for developers versus the actual player?
I do. I think it gives them a chance to kind of tweak things, see how things are going, get community feedback, and kind of figure out what technical issues they might have, as well as issues with the story. And it might be too late for them to make major changes in the process. I mean, especially if you look at Telltale. Telltale has gotten so good at basically getting a new episode. Once they start sending episodes out, they get a new episode every 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks of a particular series. It does help them kind of gauge the interest in a series and gauge where things are going to go and how they need to kind of go through those waters. Because I used to be somebody who would play games episode by episode as they came out. And now it's just so much better for me. I enjoy it so much more to like you said, to binge the games, the episodic games, play them all at once the season pass comes out, and to just do it all at one time, because that's really, any narrative tale I think is better when you don't have to put the book down every couple of weeks, which is like what a lot of episodic games have you do. It's like you're putting a book down, basically. You're putting the story down. You're leaving it on this cliffhanger. And then unlike television shows where you have to only wait maybe a week, unless you're doing Netflix, which again, you can binge, you lose that momentum, I think, when you're playing them episodically. And I think that letting it just kind of, let people just sitting on those episodes, sure, it builds up anticipation, but I think it also builds up frustration, and I personally prefer to binge now, so much like television shows.
That's so true. I mean, I never thought of it like a book. You're right. If I finish a chapter, I'm going to want to keep reading. I've done that before where I pick up a book and I'm like, oh, I got to keep reading it. And it's 4 a.m. and I got to go to work, but I need to finish this book. I got like 4 chapters left. And when you have to wait, you're right. It's so frustrating. I usually wait and just buy the whole thing when it's over. And I don't see why they just don't make the whole game. I think it's kind of like a money grab at that point.
Well, I think, yeah, definitely. And I think in terms of Telltale, I think they used to have issues doing, you know, having these whole games come out at once. You know, that's why they started the episodic model really way back in the day. And there was a longer time between episodes because they were working on them. You know, they were spending more time between episodes. And I think that now, with obviously more technology and all this influx of money they've had since The Walking Dead, they can kind of do everything all at once, but they don't want to let go of the tradition of doing things episodically. Whereas other companies like Square Enix with Hitman and with Life is Strange and other folks who have tried the episodic model, I think it really is just a way for them to continue to build hype for a particular game. And so this way, when they do put out the season pass, they can potentially make more money because they'll have already sold so many people on it. And hopefully the hype of the story will get people to kind of commit to it maybe later in the series and possibly even before there's a bad ending, because I also know there are people who like myself, like I liked the Telltale Batman series for 3 of the 5 episodes. And after the 3rd episode, I was really mad at the twist that game had and told people not to get it after that. You know, I binged that, but if I had been playing it episodically, I would have been all for it the first 3 episodes. And then after that, I would have changed my tune. But because of those first 3 episodes being so great, I could have potentially helped their hype train at least early in that series. And that's kind of what they're looking for.
Another frustration I have is when games are delayed like crazy. And there's this one game called, and I don't know if other people have heard about it, but it's Mighty No. 9. And it was a Kickstarter game. And this was back in like 2013. So this is a long time ago. And you know, they met their goals, and after they met the goal on Kickstarter, all of a sudden it's like all these delays and the problems. I don't know how I feel about Kickstarter when it comes to developing games, because sometimes they'll meet the requirements, and then all of a sudden, where's the game? I mean, is this something that people should be wary of?
I mean, I definitely think you have to be careful with what you back on Kickstarter, and you have to understand that game development is not always as smooth a process as people anticipate. In the case of Mighty No. 9, you had Inafune, who, of course, was one of the great minds behind Mega Man. And he had the huge rift with Capcom, and he had that huge falling out, but he wanted to keep making Mega Man games. So Mighty No. 9 was basically what he was calling a spiritual successor to Mega Man. A lot of people tore it apart because of the time delays and because it wasn't up to snuff, but it wasn't a bad game. It wasn't a great game, but it wasn't a bad game. But I mean, you know, yeah, Inafune ended up setting all these stretch goals and asking for more money, and they got all this money. And I think that they kind of just didn't know how much was actually going to go into this game, because usually, I mean, Inafune was used to having the resources of Capcom, having a massive team, and this time he didn't have that massive team. He had his own personal team of maybe a dozen people, and it was a lot more work and a lot more time than I think they anticipated. And this isn't the first time this has happened. It's happened with Tim Schafer, who, of course, is a legend of point-and-click adventure games from his days back at LucasArts and everything, and then, of course, now with Double Fine, you know, being one of the CEO, president, co-founder of Double Fine. With Broken Age, they did Kickstarter, and it was the same thing, and it ended up being, they didn't realize that even though they well surpassed their original goal, that they ended up losing, you know, they ended up needing more money, they needed more time, and they ended up actually having to split the game into 2 parts and selling the first part of the game, kind of talking about episodic, selling the first part of the game to help find money to finish the second part. And I just think that sometimes a lot of these smaller companies kind of, when they don't have the backing of a major publisher, whether it's Capcom or EA or Deep Silver even, or somebody like, I mean, that's what ended up happening with Mighty No. 9, is that Deep Silver came in and helped with the publishing and distribution, which ended up saving a lot of costs and allowing Mighty No. 9 to finally hit store shelves. they I think a lot of these smaller companies just don't understand when they set those financial goals, they don't anticipate problems. And when problems happen, problems cost money to fix. And suddenly, you know, the money, the small pool of money that you had, suddenly you need more. And I think that so I think people need to be wary. I mean, those are Inafune and Tim Schafer are two game developers with tremendous pedigrees who ended up at some point finally delivering everything they promised to their fans, but there were a lot of issues on the way getting there. So I definitely think that although Kickstarter is fun, and if there is a passion project that you think deserves to be backed, also don't be afraid to hold these people's feet to the fires, because it's all well and good to have an idea and it's all well and good to have a plan, but sometimes those plans need to change, and sometimes because there's only X amount of dollars and because the Kickstarter only lasts for so long, sometimes things can go belly up. So be very careful. Be careful when you donate to a Kickstarter or an Indiegogo or a Patreon or anything like that. Because unless, you know, even guys with these great pedigrees, it ain't easy to finish a game.
You know, speaking of big developers and their money, I mean, you would think that these developers would get enough money from the games that they make. Why are they going towards these microtransactions? And I'm starting to know, like, loot boxes, where it's like it's not just a season pass anymore. They want you to get, like, something additional. And it's like, okay, I paid $60 for a game. I'm paying, you know, another $50 for a season pass. And now just to get extra stuff, I'm going to be ending up paying another $40. I mean, that's a lot of money for one game. Why are these developers kind of doing this now?
Well, they're doing it for a lot of reasons. First, it is an easy way for them to make extra money and to recoup some of that overhead more quickly from what they lost putting into the game and spending on the game. You'll end up seeing, like, it's easy for somebody to be like, oh, we're going to make, it's easy to make skins and to make, you know, little cosmetic items and then putting them in loot crates. The thing is that most people won't buy them, or they'll do what I do, is like in Gears of War, let's say, and you'll grind for the currency, and then you'll, you know, you won't buy as many packs as you put forward real world cash. But then again, you don't want to put forward real world cash. But all they need, and all these companies like rely on, especially at mobile games that are almost exclusively rely on microtransactions, they're looking for what we call the whales. They're looking for that 1% of the audience that is going to end up dropping $300-$500 past launch on cosmetic stuff, on stuff for the game, on weapons and whatnot, in the hope because that person just, they need everything. They're a collectionist. And it sucks because they're preying on somebody's, kind of like their weakness, basically, really. But, you know, it's a big revenue stream for a lot of these games and a lot of these companies, to find those few people within their community who can't help themselves and will spend way more money than they should, way more money than the actual cost of the game, and will buy these really meaningless things. You know, for cosmetic stuff. I mean, sure, there's sometimes you get map packs and things like that, and those I kind of understand a little bit more. But that, you know, kind of has like DLC. But the microtransactions are, I mean, they're what's keeping some companies afloat right now, and it's why you see a lot of companies, particularly EA, kind of making sure that almost all of their games have some sort of microtransaction function in them, just because they know that there are people out there who, as soon as they see this, can't help themselves and will spend more money. And for them, it's very minimal development time. It's very minimal resources. And so it's a huge profit. It's a huge return on their investment when they find those people who are willing to drop that extra money on costumes and skins and weapon skins and the like.
What I think is kind of unfortunate is, I think I like that you said that it's the 1%, like the whales, but those are also the ones who are very passionate about the game. And I think it's really unfortunate that they're kind of taking advantage of their biggest fans. That's kind of, I think that's kind of a disservice. It'd be one thing if it's, you know, the game lasted forever and I had a skin and, you know, I'm still going to play this game 5 years from now. But most of the time, these games are like churn 'em and burn 'em. After 2 years, it's a brand new game, and you got to buy them all over again. It'd be nice if they grandfathered those skins and all that other stuff that you had in there, but they don't even do that.
Typically, no, they don't. Occasionally, if you do have certain items, like you'll have you'll get special items, or you'll get legendary items, or you'll get something that says, hey, you were here with the first game of the series or something, but not always, not all the time. I know Destiny 2, a lot of people are up in arms because a lot of the Destiny 2 is going to basically force everyone to start at zero again 3 years now after the first game came out, after all these expansions and all these microtransactions. I know a lot of people were up in arms over that. It's the ugly corporate culture of video games. You know, there's, as much as there's these great developers and these amazing creative minds, there's still a business side, and there's people who are very good at the business side and managing the business side and managing the money and forcing the devs to do these little things that, you know, you and I might not like, but again, to appeal to that 1%, that hardcore fan base that they're really kind of taking advantage of, in the hopes of making more money to keep the series going, to keep paying people. And that's the thing, as video games make more money, and as more people are needed to make bigger games, and as these companies grow, you know, revenues, you know, to maintain that $60 price point for the base game that most consumers enjoy, it's kind of the trade-off, you know, is that there's got to be another revenue system, there's got to be another source of revenue coming in from somewhere. And microtransactions is where this comes from a lot of companies.
Speaking of another revenue source, Nintendo's Super NES Classic, there was supposed to be a pre-order, wasn't there? I was looking for it all over the place, and I'm like, I couldn't find it at all. Was there a pre-order for Super NES, or did I just miss it?
I believe there was a pre-order. I was trying to figure that out myself. There was a lot of conflicting reports about the pre-orders had happened. They were already sold out. And they were saying there was no pre-orders. It's been, as typical Nintendo, it's been a bit of a mess in terms of trying to get these things into the hands of people, or potentially getting slips into the hands of people. And the real thing is that I believe there was a pre-order. The question now is that will Nintendo be able to meet the supply of the demand from the pre-orders? Some people are saying that there was pre-orders, but that there were more pre-orders sold than there are actually going to be Super NES Classics shipped. So what might end up happening is you might have a pre-order, but that might not guarantee you a system until a couple weeks after the Super NES Classic came out, because people are wondering if Nintendo can meet the demand of the Super NES Classic. And it's a very legit question. So it'll be interesting to see come later this year if those pre-orders are honored. And not only if they're honored, but if they're honored in a timely manner.
I don't know. I was looking at it, and I was like, I kind of want one, but I was like, I really have a Super NES. So I was like, the collector in me is like, you have to get it. And then the realist is like, well, you already have it, so so why are you doing this? But it looks really cool. And I was like, oh, Walmart said that they're pre-ordering, and then like, I read that Nintendo told them to take it down, or that it was already done. And I was like, I don't know what's going on anymore. It was really weird. But I did read that Nintendo, I don't know if they trademarked it or they repatented it, the Nintendo 64. So that may come out now, right? N64?
There are rumors now that there'll be also an N64 classic. And I'm kind of getting tired of these classic things. I'd rather them just get the virtual console completely up and running on the Switch. But I mean, supposedly they're making a huge profit on this. So, and it's kind of reminding people again why they should love Nintendo and all this. And I really wonder what all the reasons are behind it. Are they just trying to reinstill, you know, confidence in the brand? Are they trying to undermine all the ROMs and emulators that are out there, and trying to remind people that they don't need to illegally download this stuff? Or are they just basically trying to cut their own cut of the profit of that market? It just seems like it would be better if they maybe offered like special bundles on the virtual console instead of having to do all this manufacturing and shipping, especially when it seems they struggle to meet the demand so much. But it's an interesting conundrum, and I wouldn't be surprised if an N64 classic is coming, but I would be a little disappointed at this point.
I'm waiting for the Dreamcast classic. That's what I'm waiting for.
I think you're going to be waiting a very long time.
I don't know. I want to see that. I want to see Sega do something, because I've been, I think At Games is the one who's making like the Sega classic stuff, and at least that's what I found on Amazon. I could be wrong. But I'm waiting for Dreamcast because those games are so hard to find. Because it's really easy to find NES games, Super NES games, Nintendo 64, because everybody played them. Everybody had them. But Dreamcast, those you can't find anywhere, or at least like not scratched up, or you can always find the golf ones and the hockey ones. But you played one golf game. You played them all.
Yes.
It's like I can't stand another golf game. I'm sorry. I hope nobody like shoots me for that, but I just can't stand golf games. One of the games I know that came out recently was Splatoon. Am I saying that right? Splatoon, or is it Splatoony?
Yes, it's Splatoon.
Okay, good. So Splatoon, and I didn't play the first one. So, and I've heard some people say like, "Oh, this is like the greatest thing ever." So I sat down and I was like, "Okay," I went and I bought Splatoon and I played it on the Switch. And my God, it gave me a headache a little bit. It was kind of weird to play it, and like the controller, you can move up and down, and then there's the camera can go vertical, it can go horizontal, and I was like, "What is this? I don't know what I'm doing anymore." But what do you think of the game?
So I enjoyed Splatoon 2. It's basically, I mean, it's a bit more like Splatoon 1.5, to be honest. Like it there's not a lot of, you know, the campaign's a little deeper. There's new weapons, there's new maps, you know, but I don't think it's as deep as Nintendo could have gone with a sequel. I think it really feels like still this is Nintendo trying to get franchises that were that did well on the Wii U, but not well enough because the Wii U didn't have a good enough install base, that they're basically like, well, here, if you didn't play Splatoon 1, here's Splatoon really 1.5, and you can still kind of enjoy all of this stuff and get into this universe. And look, we're Nintendo. We made a shooter, but it's not a shooter. It's a fun little paintball game kind of thing. And it's kind of like a shooter, and it's you know, I enjoyed it. It wasn't bad. It's not as big a sequel as I think a lot of people anticipated going from Splatoon 1 to Splatoon 2. But that's really my only complaint with it. I do admit the controls are a little wonky. It takes some time to get used to. If you're gonna use the motion controls, which you can turn off, it does take time to get used to those. You know, otherwise, if you're like me, you just use the twin sticks because that's what you're used to playing a lot of other shooters. There are actually some people who swear by the motion controls. They say they get a better, a more refined experience, that it's almost like using the mouse and keyboard on a computer. I don't buy that, but that's what they say. So there's that. But I think overall, Splatoon 2 was, to me, it's a lot of fun. It's a nice take it's Nintendo's take on the shooter, and I think it's a fun take, and it's something that if you have a Switch, I definitely think it's probably the Switch game to buy for the summer, at least until Mario and Rabbids comes out at the very end of August.
When it comes to any kind of shooting game, because this is, I consider Splatoon to be a shooting game, like a first-person, well, not first-person shooter, but along those lines, and I'm totally scared of going into the multiplayer because I don't want to get killed by somebody who's much better at this game than I am. Have you gone into the multiplayer at all?
Yeah, and the thing is I think because it's kind of such a goofy premise of just trying to paint everything, I think the multiplayer, even though there are definitely people out there who are like pros at it, I think that there's less pressure in Splatoon 2. I think also because, especially there are modes where it's just, you just have to paint the landscape and it's not about your KD. It's about how much you paint the battlefield. I think that even if you're not experienced, you can still help your team out. And I think that's the big appeal for Splatoon and Splatoon 2 is that although there is definitely that professional level that you can reach, the bar of entry is far lower than most other shooters. And you can still contribute to your team and to them potentially winning if you just go in there. So I think that I can understand your intimidation for multiplayer, but I think Splatoon and Splatoon 2 is actually far less intimidating overall than most other shooters out there.
I hope so, because I know when I play Call of Duty or just any kind of shooting game, even Gears of War, I got to be carried. I'm not going to lie. Someone has to carry me because I suck. So I'm like, I really like the concept. Like you said, you get to paint everything. I like the concept of Splatoon, but I was like, you know, I don't want somebody to carry me because I hate when I have to carry people. So I'm like, I always try to stay away from the multiplayer because I'm like, it's just my luck. My KD is going to be fucking horrible. And it's like, oh, what am I going
to
do?
Yeah, no, I'm the same way. I don't like being carried either. I like, you know, I don't like having to do the carry. I just want everybody to pull their own weight, you know?
But, yeah.
I think in Splatoon, you can definitely pull your own weight a lot easier than not. So I definitely think you should give it a shot. Fight the bullet, Mason. I think you should give it a try.
Just throw myself in there and die every 2 seconds. Like, why not, right?
I don't think you would die every 2 seconds. I think you would do better than you think you will.
Yeah, I probably would, but you know what it is if I set the bar really low and then when I go way beyond it, I feel a little bit better about my experience then.
Fair enough. Fair enough. All right, so the bar is very, very low then.
Yeah, so when I die like 3 times, I'll be like, "Yes, you know, I'm pro at this game at this point." Well, for those listening, Ray, where can they find you at?
Well, basically, all my Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, personally, all of it's just at Ray Carcillo. YouTube, Ray Carcillo, all that fun stuff. Obviously, also, you can read my reviews, EGMnow.com, which is the Electronic Gaming Monthly website. I just reviewed this week Pyre from Supergiant Games, the guy who's made Bastion and Transistor, and that game was fantastic, so you should go read my review when you get a chance. That's it. The personal stuff at Ray Carcillo, professional stuff, EGMnow.com.
Well, thanks for joining me. I really appreciate you being here, Ray.
No problem, Mason. It's always a pleasure.
This has been the Mason Vera Payne Show. Thanks for listening. Can't wait to hear more? Subscribe, rate, and comment at masonverapayne.com. That's MASONVERAPAINE.com. Also, follow Mason on Facebook and Twitter at Mason Vera Payne. That's all one word. And don't forget to share the show with your friends.